It can't be that the things we normally use to explain the origin of our species, which is, you know, being, oh, we have such big brains and have amazing technology. It can't be that those alone are what explain why we're the only ones left. It had to be something else. So what would that magic ingredient likely be? Maybe there were multiple, but one had to be, in my mind, that we had an increase in our friendliness and that allowed us to cooperate and communicate in new ways. There's so much counter evidence that humans are friendly, but I do think that thinking this way helps solve the main paradox of our species, which is that we have evolved to be the kindest human that ever existed, but we also are the cruelest at the same time.
How did the book come about? What's the story that got you interested in the subject that made you dedicate so much of your life to creating it?
Well, I think the big moment for me was I was in Siberia with foxes that had been selected to be friendly towards humans. And I had basically been convinced to travel to Siberia on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. And this is around 2003, by my PhD advisor. And we had a debate. I thought that if you wanted to have a smarter fox, you had to breed for smartness. And he argued, no. I think they might be smarter, even though they've only been bred to be nice. And so I went to Siberia thinking that these really nice, friendly foxes that had been selected to be nice to people wouldn't be any smarter, but they were. And so to back out a little bit, the experiment was that they took a population of foxes and they split it in two. And half of the population, every year when the new puppies were born, they would test all of the the fox kits around 7 months, and they would stand in front of them. And if the fox kits approached and were friendly, they would then take those fox kits and breed them with other friendly fox kits. And they did that every year. And they've been doing it since 1959. And they're still, to my knowledge, doing it. I said they split the population. The other half they used as a control line. And they bred randomly for how they interact with people. So they didn't stand in front of them and breed them based on how they reacted to people. But they kept them otherwise in identical captive situation. They fed them the same, they watered them the same, they interacted with them the same, everything's the same for over 50 years now. And the remarkable thing that happened was, even though they selected the foxes to be friendly to people, they had all sorts of changes that you wouldn't necessarily have predicted. They got curly tails, their faces got shorter, their coat colors changed, their teeth became smaller, their stress system is less reactive, and they have higher serotonin, which is basically related to, you know, basically risk taking and aggression. And so they basically have a level of serotonin that is like five times the level of the control population. So they're less aggressive, friendlier. But they also wag their tail for joy and pee for joy when they see people. And so all these changes that happened are things we would associate with domestication, even though all they selected for was friendliness. So I went because I wanted to know what the impact of domestication was on psychology, cognition. And that's what started the whole thing, was I went to study this population of friendly foxes and found out I was wrong, that evolving to become friendly actually has a huge impact on your ability to cooperate and communicate.
Fascinating. And I know this is a very big question, but after you learned that, where did things go from there? What were your eventual epiphanies, realizations about how this might apply to humans? I know you talk a lot about a variety of animals in your book, but, you know, roughly speaking, where did you go from there and what did you learn?
Well, it wasn't a plan. There was a lot of insight, not a lot of foresight. So insight being, you realize that, oh, these things are related to each other, not that we sat back and we're like, oh, we should do this, 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 and that'll lead us to where we didn't have a plan. We just reacted to what we were discovering. And so there was a lot of independent research going on. So we were, I've done a lot of comparisons of human infants to chimpanzees and bonobos. And all of that work was, there's kind of multiple things that that's targeted at. But one of the main things is trying to identify what humans are able to do psychologically that make us different from our great ape relatives. And then we were working on that. And then we were also trying to study differences between different animal species, because we were trying to understand how cognition evolves. So I was looking at bonobos and chimpanzees that are very similar in many ways, but also are in some very striking ways socially different from one another. So we were just trying to measure and see if they really are as different as what we had suspected they were. And then I was working with dogs, and they were doing interesting things that were surprising, because they seemed very human-like in some ways, that they look like human infants and their ability to understand our gestures. And so we got interested in, you know, how that evolved. Where did that come from? Why are they so good at something? If they're so distantly related, why should they be able to be so good at something that, you know, it ends up some primates aren't particularly good at, other primates aren't particularly good at. So, and all those things were sort of independent, and, you know, there had been no intention to string them together and see them as being relevant to one another. But it just ended up, when we ended up with the foxes, because we were trying to understand how this ability evolved in dogs, that discovery then sort of, you know, started a process where we realized that a lot of the things that we had been working on were speaking to each other and told this larger story that, you know, the secret to life really is evolving new forms of friendliness that then lead to enhanced cooperation. And that if you look across nature, really where you have either organisms or classes of organisms have some giant evolutionary leap where they become dominant and outcompete other organisms, is because they become friendly in a way that allows them to cooperate in new ways. And so that's sort of the story, was these independent research programs, because there was sort of an epiphany on one of them, it made us realize they were all actually telling a larger story.
I've done a lot of episodes on the show about trying to understand human nature and where we come from. And this is a subject that has been touched on a little bit in prior interviews, but I don't think in quite the detail that you go into related to the importance of cooperation in the human story. And, you know, you talk about empathy, you already used the word friendliness before. In as best we understand it now, how would you describe our own story about, you know, we are obviously the at the top of the food chain in many ways on this planet. How do these qualities that we possess, that I think you note are also observable in other animals, how do you make sense of that quality being selected for in our own evolutionary history? I know one of the words I kept coming across in doing research for this conversation was your counterintuitive narrative about the story of what it means to be us and how it flies in the face of a lot of the other prevailing theories about survival of the fittest, meaning the survival of the strongest. I'd love to give you some space to kind of flesh that out a little bit as best you understand it for the listeners.
Sure. Yeah, no. So survival of the fittest, I'm glad you said that, comparing to survival of the friendliest. What's the story there? Let's unpack it. So survival of the fittest was, you know, coined by a contemporary of Darwin. Darwin actually used the term in the fifth edition of Origin of Species. And really, it was meant to indicate that a species that had higher reproductive success, or the ability to reproduce or survive and reproduce, was more fit. So fitness doesn't mean like, oh, I've got big muscles and I'm strong. It's not that kind of fitness. It's a specific, you know, jargony biological term that means you actually are being successful at surviving and having offspring, which means you'll pass your heritable material on to the next generation. So what happened in the popular mind and how it got misconstrued and used politically was that, oh, okay, so survival of the fittest means that you have to be big, strong, aggressive, and mean to survive and reproduce. And those that aren't big, strong, and alpha, and mean, whether it's an individual or groups of individuals, they're going to be weak, and they'll be stamped on and stamped out. So obviously, what we're learning from evolution is be alpha, big, mean, and strong. That must be the lesson. Where it really gets off course is when there's some kind of moral value given to those that are big, mean, and strong. So because you're, especially when it starts intersecting with political ideology, the idea that, oh, well, if you're big, strong, and alpha, that you're more likely to, you're better somehow at surviving and reproducing, which means you're better. And if you're better, well, then you must have more higher moral value. And that's where we get in big trouble. That's why evolutionary theory, which is, a biological theory of how life, happened and changes and operates, and it's a lawful property of the universe, just like gravity. It got completely misconstrued and misused politically, and misunderstood, because obviously big, strong, and alpha is better. I mean, duh. But it's actually not true. It's very costly to in nature, whether you're a human or a non-human, to exert energy to be aggressive or to be alpha or to bully. And there's lots of evidence for that. Species that are what are known as despotic species that have a very aggressive social system. It is not an easy existence. There's a cost to that type of what's known as life history or behavioral pattern. So survival of the friendliest is actually, if you step back and you look at nature writ large and take this larger picture, and you say, forget all the political stuff and actually just turn back to being a biologist again. And you say, okay, well, what is it in life that leads to success? Well, it is when you have a new form of friendliness evolved that allows for enhanced cooperation. So let's just take a couple of examples that are non-human, and then we'll turn to humans. So non-human examples would be flowering plants. So flowering plants are one of the newest forms of plants. And how have they rapidly become dominant on the planet? Well, they offer in friendliness a meal, and they cooperate with pollinators that then take their reproductive material and spread it all around. And it allows them to be hybridized and reproduce much faster and respond quicker to changes in the environment. And they are now, again, incredibly successful, dominant type of plant. Again, a new type of friendliness evolves, and attracting pollinators, having insects be attracted to them for a meal, and then they get a gift of this cooperative exchange of their reproductive material. A simpler example would be there's only one vertebrate lives year round on Antarctica. There are other animals that live in Antarctica, but they don't live there year round. The only one is the emperor penguin, and they survive the winter by hugging. They're attracted to each other in a way that most birds sitting up on the everybody's seen on the telephone pole, birds always have a little space between them. You can be close, but not that close. Don't get too close to me. These emperor penguins evolved a new type of friendliness to be attracted to each other, to be near each other, and to stay near each other and to cooperate to stay warm all winter, sharing body heat. And that's why they can live somewhere that no other species can live all year round. The only terrestrial vertebrate in Antarctica. Another, the best evidence for survival of friendliness are our own dogs. So the story of domesticated dogs is a story that we know based on the work we describe for the foxes. We have all sorts of evidence to suggest that dogs evolved from wolves, and they evolved from a population of wolves that were interacting with humans who had no agriculture. It was long before the Industrial Revolution and long before agriculture. And so they would have been interacting with humans who were foraging and hunting and were direct ecological competitors with wolves. What happened was, like the fox experiment, a population became attracted to humans, and they became attracted to a super predator that was generating a lot of garbage and a lot of material around their settlements that would have been really easy to get and reliable and low risk, especially if you could sneak in dawn dusk or at night when people were asleep. And the individuals in the population who did that were at a huge adaptive advantage. Basically you had selection like you had in the foxes that led the foxes to have curly tails and different morphology. It happened in this population of wolves, and our relationship was born from there. So the idea is that dogs evolved through a selection for friendliness, but it was not humans saying, waking up one morning and saying, hey, let's make dogs. It was natural selection operating and favoring the wolves that were able to take advantage of this new resource. And finally, lastly, to our own species, we sort of use that same logic to look at bonobos versus chimpanzees, and that gave us more confidence. But the story of our own species is one where one of the big surprises in evolutionary anthropology, and I have to brag on my field for a moment. People don't really, when you think of human evolution, you don't think of a fast moving, exciting field with, rapid change, but nothing could be further from the truth. The last year's Nobel laureate in medicine was an evolutionary anthropologist. In the last 10, 15 years, we've had a revolution in our understanding that our species was not alone on this planet until very, very recently. And that's a big change in our understanding of human evolution. There were many species of humans until 25,000 to 50,000 years ago. And in fact, if you were to travel in time 100,000 years ago, our species origin is traced back to about 300,000 years. But 100,000 years ago, there would have been lots of human species, and you probably wouldn't have bet on ours to be the one still here now. The other thing is that all the species that existed at the time, let's say 100,000 years ago, they all had big brains. They all had pretty impressive technology relative to non-humans. And they all were almost certainly linguistic in a way that we would recognize, able to express and cooperate and communicate in ways that we would, be impressed by. But all those traits, big brain, technology, and the ability to have some kind of linguistic communication, what they predict is extinction, because we're the only ones left. So it can't be that the things we normally use to explain the origin of our species, which is, we have such big brains and have amazing technology, it can't be that those alone are what explain why we're the only ones left. It had to be something else. Otherwise, we almost certainly would be lining up at the airport with multiple species of humans. And you think it's complicated now to get on an airplane. So what would that magic ingredient likely be? Maybe there were multiple, but one had to be in my mind, that we had an increase in our friendliness and that that allowed us to cooperate and communicate in new ways. So we outline in the book a theory about exactly how that could have happened. And it's counterintuitive because we don't, there's so much counter evidence that humans are friendly. But I do think that thinking this way helps solve the main paradox of our species, which is that we have evolved to be the kindest human that ever existed, but we also are the cruelest at the same time.
And when you, which I'm sure people have put this to you, you know, I'd love to get your, in whatever length of time you'd like to provide your working definition of what you mean when you say friendly, when you're talking to me with that response, I mean, my first instinct is that essentially just a fill-in word for the most cooperative. And maybe we can just start there by giving you some time to talk about what you mean by the friendliest and how that contrasts with just the blanket statement that it's survival of the most cooperative species that ends up out competing other humans that are around from 25,000 or 100,000 years ago. I'd love to put that to you and get any response you might have.
Yeah, no. So the definition of friendliness is very parsimonious. It's very simple and very biological in origin, in the sense that it really is just fear is replaced with attraction. So the probably the most dramatic example of this is the cleaner wrasse. So cleaner wrasse are fish that do something that on the surface seems ridiculous. They not only do not swim away from predatory fish, they swim towards them. And not only do they swim towards them, they swim in their mouths. That doesn't seem like something that's very adaptive. That does not seem like something that's going to lead to survival and reproduction. But it is an extraordinarily successful strategy to swim into the mouth of the predator. Wow, what? Stop it, evolution. And the reason is because their fear has been replaced with attraction. They're attracted to what they used to be afraid of. And a completely new social interaction has become possible now, where they cooperate with predatory fish to clean their mouths of parasites. And because of that, predatory fish do not target them for predation. They target them for cooperation. And so that's what we mean by friendliness, is that you can't cooperate with somebody if you're running away from them. It's really that simple. That's what we mean. And it's not, it's friendliness to be distinguished from something like compassion or kindness, or that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about just the fact that, like the penguins huddling together in Antarctica, birds in most contexts are not attracted. They don't want to sit near each other. It's like, you know, putting the north and the south of the magnet, you know, next to each other. They're going to repulse each other. But then something happens in evolution where the magnet switches and now they're attracted. That's the first step. And then once you have that attraction, now we're interacting, and we're interacting in new ways. And even our old cooperative abilities we might have used in different social interactions can be applied to this new relationship. Or it can be that that new relationship leads to new types of enhanced cooperation. So that's the idea, is that the first step of a species or class of organism being having a new way to be successful is something you were fearful or unattracted to, you now are attracted to and want to be near and interact with. And that just that attraction is what then leads to the potential for all sorts of new types of cooperation and problem solving. And so that's the idea. In the human case, as a dookie, and a Cameron crazy, you know, when I talk about this, I always put up a picture of Cameron and all the Cameron crazies, because it is the perfect example of the type of friendliness I think that was selected for in humans that make us the friendliest species of human that ever evolved. And that is that we are attracted to strangers. We are xenophilic. So if we have this unbelievable ability as humans to, as adults, and think of the Cameron crazies, these are 18-year-olds from all over the world, all over the country, with all sorts of different backgrounds. They do not meet each other until they're 18 years old. And after a few basketball games or one basketball season, or maybe even a few weeks, you know, on campus, and they have a shared identity and they care about each other almost as if they're family. And no other species can do that. And no other species can form bonds with non-family member strangers so quickly or even at all. That leads to that type of cooperation. So what are we attracted to? We're attracted to strangers that share our identity. And whereas most species are repulsed to strangers of their same species, chimpanzees being a great example, they're highly xenophobic. One of our two closest relatives, if they meet a strange chimpanzee, whether they've ever seen them or not, if they're not a group member, they are either afraid or aggressive towards that individual. Mm-hmm. In humans, if we're in a context where we're meeting new individuals and we're going to make a shared identity, or we already share an identity, we can be completely bonded, like we're family, and work together on all sorts of things. And it is the true power of human psychology. And it's why, you know, we have the amazing cultural products that we have as a result.
I think anyone would look around the world and agree that something is really working with human beings, because there wouldn't be 8 billion of us without something incredible, really clicking in evolutionary terms in that way. And I think even looking at a modern economy like the United States, the fact that people can trade and work with each other to complete strangers that they'll never meet are playing an integral role in what they're buying and putting into their homes, or how they're living their lives with what they're purchasing. You know, I think that's a great example of, and I'm glad you brought up that word, a shared identity, that I remember that from going into Duke, that was, you know, an integral part of becoming a freshman there. And very quickly, everybody is dressed the same and part of this new team, a new identity. And to me, when I hear that, and I would love to get your thoughts on this, that you're essentially quickly creating a new tribal identity, that you've become part of this new group identity, and thereafter, you know, have a collective spirit about you. That being said, anyone who's gone to Cameron and has seen UNC players come in, or any other team, it doesn't get homicidal, but it can get rather nasty rather quickly. And I think, I'm sure you've gotten these questions from writing your book, that if we were purely, and I don't think this is what you're getting at, but if we were purely leading with friendliness, and cooperativeness, the world would look different than it does in terms of some of the major threats that, you know, we face as Americans, the wars we faced historically. And I'd love to turn this around into that lens a little bit and give you an opportunity to respond to how the darker sides of group identity can flare up, and our own cooperativeness an ability to form group identity can really come back to create massive destruction and horror and suffering. I'd love to give you an opportunity to respond to that and to go into detail as to how this cooperative super skill that we have can also be, weaponized against our collective better interests.
Yes, absolutely. So the idea is that, you know, we are attracted to strangers that we can form a shared identity with. We can become we can have bonds like family, even though we're strangers and totally unrelated. It means that more people can work together. It means you've got more minds tied together. It means more innovations and ideas are being shared faster, which is basically supercharges cultural learning. Mm-hmm. So, there's the famous saying of, we stand on the shoulders of giants. But we don't just stand on the shoulder of giants. We show, because of the ability to be attracted to strangers and shared identity that we have the possibility for, we stand on the shoulder of thousands or millions of giants. And so there's this collective knowledge, a mass of collective knowledge that we have access to, which just supercharges innovation and cultural learning. And so that's what the key to, you know, why we can have all the things that we're able to do with our technology. So that said, absolutely. Well, the first thing, let me just pause, because mostly when in today's world, when we think about, you know, people talk about tribalism or shared identity, it's like, oh, it's, that's all bad. Like, you know, we all have these different identities, we can't get along. But the argument is, actually, there's a reason that it's so strongly ingrained in us, is because actually it's the secret to our species success that we have these identities. And actually the origin of it is an ability to have a new type of friendliness that allows for cooperation. Now, the challenge, of course, is that it allows for this identity and cooperation allows for success in a competitive world, competing for resources, et cetera. So, the reason that it also helps explain human cruelty is we are xenophilic, attracted to strangers that we can develop a shared identity with, or we already share an identity with. We speak the same language, or we like the same team, or eat the same food, whatever it is. But if we meet a stranger who we either cannot assess their identity, or we realize are of a different identity, whatever that identity is, it could be religion, language, food, where you're from, some way you know, your hairstyle or what you look like, how much melanin you have in your skin. I mean, it could be tattoos, no tattoos. We are so flexible in how we build our identities and what we build our identities around. That's one of the other remarkable things. But if for some reason, something that we currently think is meaningful, that, you know, differentiates different identities, if we meet somebody who's strange to us, who signals they don't share our identity, then we're xenophobic. Then we are fearful. We're not attracted. And that's when all the darker parts of human nature express themselves. And they express themselves and can express themselves in as extreme way as our kindness and friendliness can express themselves towards those we share an identity with. And if we're taking an evolutionary perspective, the argument would be, okay, so we have these shared identities, our group sizes are getting bigger, we're innovating, and our technology is progressing much faster. But for some reason, there's another group we meet that's threatening our group and our group identity. And the cognition and the psychology that allows us to care about each other and work together and me understand what you want and mean and how you feel. Mm-hmm. And that's, even though we didn't know each other and we're strange to one another, the argument is that when we feel threatened by another group, especially individuals or a group that threaten our identity, and our, that we care about, that actually, that same psychology that allows for all the cooperation, it starts to shut down specifically towards those individuals. We don't attribute full humanity to the individuals or groups that we feel threaten our own group. And that allows for the potential for moral exclusion. I don't see that particular group at, it's not that I just dislike that group. So I think Duke and Carolina fans, they just dislike each other. That's fine. In the Georgia Tech rivalry, it was called good old fashioned and clean hate. And so it's not dislike. That's very strong dislike. It's more than that. It's seeing that the other isn't even human. They're not fully human. And so the argument we make in the book is that what takes a rivalry to a dangerous point is when dislike turns into dehumanization. And that's where human psychology towards another group that allows for kindness and empathy shuts down. And it's where there's potential permission for moral exclusion. So the normal things I would have to do as a human, morally obligated to treat you as another human being are no longer applied to individuals in that group that are threatening my own group. So that's the argument. And so, and the observation really, the evidence for is, so if you're starting from the point of how can you explain the worst forms of human cruelty, whether it's genocide or war, mass murder, et cetera, there's always a signature of dehumanization, not just dislike.
Which would make sense because in a tribal setting, if back in the day, if you were convinced that there was a group who did not mean you well, viewing them as a threat probably would be to your advantage, and not ascribing to them the normal qualities of a positive human relationship might behoove you in that setting. And I'm so glad we're talking about this because I've had a few conversations on this show about modern political polarization. And I'm sure this must come up in your classes. I mean, we're really less than 2 months away from what I'm sure will be a, at times, very toxic presidential campaign. Less than 3 months away from a presidential election. And inevitably, there will be probably 50 million plus Americans who vote for each candidate. Many of those 50 million truly dislike, borderline hate the opposition. And I know you sit and, you know, lead classroom seminars with young people who might be voting for the first time. I'd love to give you an opportunity, given your knowledge about all of this, to, if I'm correct, that this is a subject that you think about and you talk about in your classroom, how you present this, these ideas to your students in trying to shepherd a healthy conversation to help them kind of deal with this moment. Not that this is uniquely toxic per se. We've lived through some pretty difficult presidential elections ourselves. But in this moment specifically, how do you think about how to instruct young minds or minds in general through the seduction of dehumanizing the other side, whether you are, you know, on one side of the political spectrum or the other?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough conversation. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that, and people have to be ready to have a tough conversation. It's a little bit like a breakup or a divorce. I mean, people are that angry. So you have to, you know, people aren't always ready to have the conversation, the tough conversation. But if someone is ready to have that tough conversation, obviously I don't have all the answers, but I certainly have what I think are, you know, a whole community of researchers, perspective, theories, evidence that suggests that what we describe, humans' ability for unbelievable kindness, but then, you know, unprecedented cruelty, that's universal to all humans. If you have a human mind or a human brain normally functioning, that you also have that psychology. That is the first step if you really want to move forward, because realizing, and I have all sorts of, I've collected all sorts of anecdotal examples off social media and even, the normal, media, mainstream media, whether it's whatever, CNN, ABC, whatever, PBS, where, there's so many examples of dehumanization of both, Republicans, Democrats, or whatever political party it is. It's not that, one side is immune to dehumanizing the other. And in fact, the main thing that predicts, the number one threat that predicts that you will dehumanize is if you perceive that you are being dehumanized. So that's what's so dangerous about dehumanization, is that it is almost always reciprocated with dehumanization from those being dehumanized. And in fact, knowing that, I think that's what some politicians are quite successful is, you know, the start of dehumanization. How do you start dehumanization? Well, you actually tell your supporters they're being dehumanized. And so then they're like, what? And then they reciprocate, even though that may or may not be true. And so if you've got reciprocal dehumanization, you've got two groups of people now who are potentially morally excluding the other group. Oh, great. Well, this is going to end well. If you're trying to move towards violence, then that's a really historically successful strategy. So, you know, that's the first thing you try to explain, because if you want to, you know, cure some malady, whatever it is, if you diagnose it as a cold, but it's cancer, you know, if you think it's bacterial, but it's viral, your treatment is probably not going to go well. So is dehumanization everything? Does it explain the whole phenomenon? No. But is it a big part of what allows for the worst? Yes, I think so. Is stopping dehumanization going to make all groups of humans get along perfectly? No, because there's all sorts of other parts of human psychology that allow for, you know, bad feelings. But is it one of the scariest parts of human nature? Yes. And I do think that, you know, at the founding of our nation, the folks who were founding the United States were extremely worried about this. And were not unfamiliar, even though they never called it dehumanization. But they were very worried about the darker parts of human nature. So the next thing is to say that it's solvable, and it is. It's very solvable. I mean, it's terrifying. But the good news is it actually is very, very plastic and very fluid. So a person can switch. You can switch on this dehumanization in most people, most normal. There's a distribution, but in most normal people, this might switch on. You might feel like some group is threatening you, and you may not even intentionally be dehumanizing, but you're feeling that way. Or maybe you are explicitly intentionally dehumanizing them, but that is very easy to turn that off. It turns off really quickly. There's plenty of evidence that, you know, if you are reminded that you have a friend who's a friend with people in that group, if you're reminded that there are members of that group who actually are not threatening and have a positive relationship with your group, if you're reminded that the groups that are competing are actually part of a larger group, like a country, that share something like citizenship, that share shared values and shared rituals. And, you know, I think this is where, you know, I'm probably guilty of this is, you know, rituals, like rituals that around citizenship, you know, let's say the Pledge of Allegiance, for instance, you know, like, I'm not like going to get up before my class when I lecture and have all my students say the Pledge of Allegiance. But why are those rituals there? They're there because that's what allows there to be this larger group. It's a shared set of experience. We agree. Like, yeah, you know, the Pledge of Allegiance, that's kind of has, you can imagine being worried about that for a variety of different reasons. But why does it exist? These rituals like that exist. So we have a shared sense of identity, and that, you know, we can have these sub identities that compete against each other, but that love of that larger thing keeps things from boiling over from dislike to dehumanization. So you know, there are other strategies that have very success that have been shown to be extremely successful. There's work in the starting in 2016 where there were dozens of psychologists and philosophers, economists, social scientists got together, and they pitched their best ideas to intervene on polarization. And they had a tournament. They literally did a tournament of the best ideas. It was like probably 80 different studies were done, And the question was like, who could have the biggest impact? And I mean, those studies have been done, these large scale anti-political polarization studies. And so, you know, there's five or six strategies that are well established that have a huge impact on this. And, you know, are they necessarily hard or expensive to deploy? Not necessarily. You know, I think that's the good news. And then the other thing is there's evidence from when people and groups, whether it's Americans, British, anywhere in the world, feel threatened. If you can, that as quickly as that turns on and as extreme as it can become, it can be turned off and become extreme friendliness as quick as it turned back on. So that's the good news. But it's also bad news because it means it's actually really fluid. Hmm. And so it means that institutions have to be built, and it has to that acknowledge and recognize this, because we're destined to repeated failure if a deep appreciation of human nature isn't baked into the system. And otherwise, you know, we'll just, it may be, you know, maybe we solve this, you know, for the next couple of decades, you know, but it could be future generations are just right back here again in 50, 60 years, because they'll still be human.
Mm. It's so well put. I mean, I love that you brought up the concern of the founders. I mean, my understanding was that they referred to that concern as factions. They were worried about Americans splitting into factions, which I think you could argue is, you know, in some capacity is a political tribe, a political party, which we see now. And one of my favorite interviews I've done on this show was with a man named David Blankenhorn, who started Braver Angels.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay. When I said the divorce, that's the kind of what I was thinking of. Exactly. Braver Angels.
Yeah. And his organization brings together Team Red and Team Blue Americans for anywhere from, I think, hours long to days long dialogue face to face with people that they think they have nothing in common with. And the biggest takeaway he says that they consistently receive in their exit forms is we're far less polarized and divided than we've been told. And one of the struggles I have to imagine is just how strong these echo chambers are that people fall into with their natural propensity for tribalism. And they are just hearing their tribe feed them information that gets them riled up. Self-righteousness is seductive. I guess that's a long-winded way of me putting this to you, that what are the strategies that you have learned about that you are convinced could potentially help lower the temperature and increase our ability to see our humanity in the other? I wrote down a line from Lincoln's first inaugural that I wanted to read, which I'm sure you've read before, which dovetails pretty nicely into this, which is, we are not enemies, but friends. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. I'd love to put that to you and get any feedback you have on what's my work.
I mean, that's one of the big findings is you already highlighted from the you know, your Braver Angel interviewee obviously has pioneered and seen, observed, is that when people realize that there's actually not that distance that was, you know, it's constantly hammered on different, you know, sources of information that they might be getting through echo chambers or whatever, that's actually one of the top, you know, three, four things. And so really it comes down to this basic model of survival of friendliness, right? Think of the magnets, right? So the magnets are repulsing each other, but all of a sudden they're attracted, boom. And they have this really strong bond and they can do all sorts of things. It's kind of that simple. You know, if people actually will take the time, because one of the other ideas is if you come into contact with other people, you realize that you are more like them than you might have first believed. And that if you can have it's not just contact in the sense that you just are near each other or see each other, but actually contact like Braver Angels, where you're able to have a conversation. You're able to realize you actually do have a shared identity in ways you didn't realize, and that you're not that different after all. Those are very powerful ways. Now, the problem is they're time intensive relative to what most people are willing or able to do. So short term, emphasizing, let's just say we were going to run our own new, news channel or whatever. I mean, if you're constantly talking, and even I watch PBS NewsHour. I mean, even PBS NewsHour, which is so great. It's such a high quality, program. They are constantly repeating that we're polarized. And so, instead of that, it would be, you'd have to make an edit, which is, we feel polarized, right? Even though we feel so polarized, right? But we're not, because, all the evidence is that actually people agree in so many ways. And so it's a little bit like the Supreme Court, where, people, what gets all the attention when they disagree, right? But the vast majority, if you take the last 10 years, the vast majority of cases over the last 10 years, like, everyone agrees, or there'd be, one dissenter, the vast, vast majority of cases. And so it's only that, whatever it is, 10% or more of cases where there's a disagreement, that's all we think about. And so that's the trick, is reorienting. And, part of the problem is it's not news, if it's normal, if there's no tension, what's the story? That's the challenge, is, having people realize we're not that different after all, that we do have a shared identity, and just being comfortable to be near each other. I mean, it really is true. And I think everyone's been having these experiences with, when you realize, oh my gosh, that's somebody who thinks and believes, in a different way politically than I do. Like, oh, now I can't say whatever. I feel uncomfortable. Oh man. That is the opposite of what has to happen for this attraction to lead to cooperation. We need to be cleaner ass, swim right in the mouth. And, cooperate.
The last question I'd love to ask you, this is such a good conversation, but to people who hear this, and, I think we both are probably in agreement to wanting to encourage people to engage more with more openness and friendliness to people that they might disagree with. In your mind, is it ever justified to dehumanize the other or another human being? That are there any circumstances in your assessment of the way in which groups can really become significantly toxic or dangerous, where you do think that tendency, that capacity in the human brain would be justified in a modern context? I'd love to maybe close with that and put that to you.
If I was a Marine drill sergeant, I certainly would think it was very important to dehumanize, because go watch Full Metal Jacket or whatever. It's very important for me to dehumanize my new recruits so they feel like they're nothing, and I can build them back up. But then it's going to be very important for me if we ever deploy, and if we are active warfighters, that they're not being tripped up by all this, theory of mind, empathy, kindness, compassion. And one of the arguments for why soldiers have struggled so much with PTSD is that you were dehumanizing the enemy, and you were together as a group, completely convinced that who you were fighting were not even necessarily fully human. And then when you come back, what makes it so hard to reintegrate is your realization that the people that you were doing these things to, you're haunted by all your memories of them actually being human, and they've become more human. And then you're really strained by that. So I'm going to say when aliens invade, it's fine to dehumanize them.
Fair enough. I really enjoyed this, Brian. Thank you so much for the time and all your work on this subject. It was great to meet you, and thanks for doing the interview.
Thank you, Dan. Go Devils.